are now at... Could we have some quiet in the room, please? Thank you. We're now at panel six, the consumers, and we will start with Ms. Polasek on behalf of the Industrial Energy Consumers of Pennsylvania. Ms. Polasek?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. My name is Pamela Polasek. I'm an attorney with McNeese, Wallace, and Nurek. We represent the Industrial Energy Consumers of Pennsylvania and various other intervention groups of commercial and industrial customers that participate regularly in proceedings before this commission. And I'm here today on behalf of all of those collective interests. IECPA and other industrial customer groups have participated actively in the Commission's processes related to demand-side response, including the prior working group, and we certainly look forward to providing input to the Commission as we go forward through this process. Many larger customers in the Commonwealth are already engaging in demand-side response and energy efficiency efforts because it makes economic sense. The efforts of those customers, however, to independently implement DSR and energy efficiency projects does create a little bit of a complication for us when we're faced with something like this, quite frankly, because it does create some concerns with the largest customers in terms of intra-class subsidization, especially of competitors, and especially for companies that may already be doing this, again, in anticipation of the rate caps coming off and potentially the prices increasing. So what we'd urge the Commission really to try and achieve here is really a delicate balance between the interests of the consumers that may have already engaged independently in some efforts related to demand-side response and energy efficiency, and the programs that may be implemented as a part of this process, and especially if those costs of those programs are going to be flowed back to the non-participating ratepayers. The Commission has set up a process to seek comment on many of the issues related to Act 129 implementation, including things like cost recovery, program design, and program evaluation. Those are things that we would prefer to really address in written comments, so I won't address it in my testimony today. My testimony today will focus really on two issues that we believe should be considered by the Commission in developing in any DSR program for the Commonwealth. Those two elements are, first, maximizing the use of available state and federal funding mechanisms as part of the plan, and second, incorporating the PJM load response programs into that plan. Now, as the Commission is aware, in July of 2008, Pennsylvania enacted Act 1 coming out of the special session that resulted in $650 million in grants and other subsidies for renewable and energy efficiency programs. There is a portion of that funding that has been earmarked for customer energy efficiency efforts. And in addition, on the federal level, we would anticipate that when the new administration takes control in January, there may be additional federal funding and initiatives that are enacted related to similar issues. Now, IECPA urges the Commission to closely examine whether and how funding from mechanisms at both the state and the federal level can be incorporated into the DSR and energy efficiency plans that we're developing here. If the rate caps on electricity are allowed to expire, customers in Pennsylvania will see very significant rate increases over the next 14 to 26 months. And we would urge you to see if there are ways that we can mitigate any of those increases and certainly not compound them by having them pay for programs when some of those costs could be absorbed by other mechanisms that are available at the state or federal levels. In addition, we've heard some discussion today about the existing PJM load response programs, and we do believe that that may be the most direct vehicle for larger customers to participate in demand-side response and provide that benefit to the Commonwealth. Retail customers can participate in certain of the PJM markets through an electric generation supplier or a curtailment service provider, a CSP. And I'll just caution here, when I use CSP, I really do mean those PJM entities that are PJM members and they've gone through a process so that they can facilitate the participation in the PJM load response programs, as opposed to some of the other uses of CSP by the prior panel, which was a little bit more broad. We've included in our testimony a chart that shows some statistics on the participation by customers in the capacity market, the reliability pricing model, RPM market. And what you'll see there is in a program called the Interruptible Load for Reliability Program, there has been some pretty robust participation in that already by customers.
And we would actually anticipate
that would increase as we go forward and we get off of the rate caps. There is a movement at the PJM level to actually eliminate the ILL program or to make substantial changes to that program that would really provide a disincentive to customers to participate in that. There are also movements at the PJM level to change the compensation level, the compensation mechanisms in other of the load response programs that we believe is providing a disincentive to customers to participate. What we'd ask the Commission certainly to consider as part of the program here is trying to make sure that those PJM programs remain vibrant for customers so that that can be an integral part of the Commonwealth's overall DSR program. Thank you, and I have actually some people in here in the hearing room today that have more information on the PJM programs themselves, so if you have questions on that in the question and answer session, we'll be available to respond.
Thank you. Next, we have Mr. Lloyd from the State Small Business Advocate.
Thank you. I'll submit my written testimony for the record and will highlight only certain portions of it. Implementing the statutory mandates to reduce peak and overall consumption could require small C&I customers to make significant changes in the way they currently operate. In addition to incurring the costs associated with these changes, small C&I customers will also be required to reimburse part of the cost of the EDC's plan and to pay higher distribution rates in the future as a result of the EDC's decline in sales. Therefore, instead of reviewing each individual EDC's plan through a comment, reply, comment, tentative order process, the Commission should follow the normal process, which creates a record and produces an opinion and order subject to appellate review. The OSBA does not agree with SEEP's implicit assumption that reduced consumption will count toward meeting the mandates of Act 129 only if the reduced consumption is the result of specific elements of the EDC's plan. The anticipated rate increases following the expiration of the rate caps should create a powerful market-based incentive for customers to conserve. In addition, the publicity surrounding the enactment and implementation of Act 129 and the information provided through the EDC's approved consumer education plans should encourage reduced consumption. Nothing in Act 129 states that such reduced consumption is to be excluded from determining if the mandates have been met. However, to be safe, an EDC could reference its first post-rate cap default service program and its consumer education plan as specific elements of its energy efficiency and conservation plan. Before developing new programs, each EDC should meet with small C&I customers within the EDC's service territory in an attempt to make existing or previously discarded programs more attractive. To achieve maximum effect, funding from the EDC and funding from the Commonwealth should be coordinated. The statute mandates that energy efficiency and conservation programs must be equitably available to all customer classes. The statute does not mandate that each class must produce approximately the same level of reduced consumption. The overriding purpose of Act 129 is to reduce consumption, even if meeting the mandated reduction requires a relatively narrow focus on the customers or customer classes which consume the largest quantities of electricity or whose consumption can most readily be shifted off-peak. For example, an effective strategy for achieving the mandated reductions would be to pay particular attention to space heating and air conditioning, regardless of how the potential savings might break down on a customer class basis. As a further example, achieving equal percentage reductions from each class will be handicapped by the fact that small C&I customers frequently are tenants and therefore lack the legal authority, the incentive, or both, to make physical plant changes in order to reduce energy consumption. I will be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Next, we have Mr. Popowski on behalf of the State Consumer Advocate.
Thank you, Your Honor, members of the Commission. First, I want to commend the Commission for having this en banc hearing. This is a daunting task before you, particularly over the next month and then over the next 8 months. And I commend the Commission for starting by having a hearing where you personally get to hear from so many parties as an input into your decision-making process. I also wanted to echo the comments that have been made by Chairman Cawley and others dating back to the passage of this act, that at least from my perspective, and I think on behalf of the residential customers that I represent, I think this is a day to celebrate. That is, as you know, Chairman Cawley, we've been talking about this. We've been talking about getting energy efficiency, demand response to residential customers for as long as you and I have been participating in cases before this commission and serving on the commission. But now it's the law of the Commonwealth. Our utilities are now obligated to take steps to assist their customers, not just talk about energy efficiency, but to actually assist their customers in meeting their needs at a lower cost. I think it's clear from the Act, from House Bill 2200, Act 129 as a whole, that the provisions of this Act are designed to change the relationship between our electric distribution companies and their consumers. It's no longer permissible, in my view, for electric utilities in Pennsylvania to accept their customer demands as a given and then serve those loads by acquiring generation at prevailing market prices. Rather, the electric utilities must now take affirmative steps to reduce and shape their loads for the benefit of all consumers and to provide needed generation to their non-shopping customers at the least cost over time through a prudent mix of long-term, short-term, and spot market purchases. Now, having said that, I view this process adversary process as a cooperative process. I think Bill Lloyd is correct. But the first thing these utilities should do as they develop their plans is meet with their customers, and not just meet with their customers, but also meet with the outstanding group of individuals that we had in the prior panel, the conservation service providers, and the community-based organizations that you'll hear from shortly. If we simply wait until July 1st, the utilities drop a plan in our lap, and then you have 120 days to decide that base. And then, after hearing from a cacophony of voices who are just seeing these plans for the first time, I think your job will be much more difficult than if the utilities cooperate and work with their consumers, with the competitive service providers, and with community-based organizations in the preparation of those plans. There are a couple of difficult issues, though, I think you do have to decide up front. The Commission has to do the initial load forecast for the year 2010-2011, something I don't think the Commission has ever done before on its own. Those need to be prepared in rapid fashion, I think, so that the companies know what their goal is, what the savings they have to produce. The second issue is, what exactly do we mean? And this has come up several times during the day when we talk about a 1% reduction, a 3% reduction, a 4.5% reduction. Reductions from what? Reductions compared to what? I think there are a couple ways to interpret the law. One is to suggest that it requires an absolute reduction in sales. The other is that we're talking about a percentage savings as compared to base year sales. But I think whichever one you choose, I think you ought to make, well, I respectfully submit you need to make that clear in your January 15th program, and I think it has to be consistent. That is, for example, there was some discussion this morning among the utility witnesses that, on the one hand, they felt that this was savings produced. What we were trying to measure was 1% savings produced by the utilities. On the other hand, I think when Vice Chairman Christie asked, well, does that include the PJM demand reduction programs? And the answer that you got, I think, was yes. So you can't have it both ways. In other words, if it's a program where we are measuring utility-sponsored energy savings and demand savings programs, then the 1%, the 3%, 4% has to be those types of programs. Finally, in terms of penalties, there was some discussion of penalties. I think the penalties are mandatory, but you have discretion as to the length of the penalties. But more importantly, I think we all hope that we never have to reach that question. Because whether it's $1 million or $20 million, consumers will be much better off if the companies have successful programs, and we never have to reach that question. And I therefore, again, hope to work with the Commission, work with the utilities in developing the most successful programs we can have over the next 5 years. Thank you.
Next, we have Mr. DeBroff on behalf of Walmart Stores.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Chairman Colley, Vice Chairman Christie, Commissioners Pizzangrelli, Paulson, Gardner, ALJ Slava. Thank you so much for having us. Alongside me is Chris Hendricks, who's the Director of Markets and Compliance for Walmart Stores. And so when we get to the comments phase, we certainly want to bring him in because he has a lot of very good detailed current knowledge on things going on currently with the company. And so we'll just get right into the slides. Just a little bit of background, that as of August 2008, Walmart's presence in Pennsylvania is the following: 83 supercenters, 41 discount stores, 23 Sam's Clubs, and 4 distribution centers. Next slide. As of September, Walmart has over 51,000 associates in Pennsylvania, also purchased over $5 billion of merchandise and services with 1,688 suppliers within Pennsylvania. As a result of our relationship with these suppliers, Walmart supports over 165,000 supplier jobs within this Commonwealth. Walmart is the largest private consumer of energy in the United States, with annual energy expenditures of over $1.9 billion. Walmart takes service from all major electric and natural gas utilities throughout the United States, and a majority of also smaller utilities as well. Next slide. The energy efficiency measures that we are involved with principally at this point in time, the first is called a daylight harvesting system, which consists of skylights, dimming ballasts, and daylight sensors. A simple explanation: the more the sun shines, the dimmer the lights in the store get, which is an extremely good option to have, and a considerable savings of energy in dollars. White membrane roofs that are solar reflectivity reduces cooling loads. Reductions in usage can be somewhere around an average of about 8%. The high-efficiency HVAC systems in the U.S. today, the industry average is somewhere between 9 and 9.5%, and for the units that we deploy, somewhere between 15.5 and 16.1%, more efficient than the code. And T8 fluorescent lamps are put in all new facilities and retrofitting in other facilities over 90% complete. The next slide. LED lighting is an important option, and illumination of sign and also refrigeration cases. Heat reclamation system, heat from refrigeration in many of the stores is reclaimed and provides for the hot water needs of those same stores, which is a great usage of that. Dehumidification, actively dehumidifying the buildings, and also for purposes higher temperature, less electricity usage. Next slide. This just gives a nice overview of the metering capability, and Walmart has a sophisticated advanced metering total solution, and so that it includes, I guess you could say it's a total energy management system. It includes both metering in each facility, also capability backup into the Walmart stores, and then back into the Walmart headquarters, out to the stores, capable of monitoring HVAC, lighting, refrigeration, sensors everywhere, and basically monitoring. So if something, if one door in a refrigeration case, for example, goes out in, say, Portland, Oregon, the EMS system will reflect that on a board in Bentonville, Arkansas, and you'll know when a door is open, so that can be adjusted. So an extremely sophisticated system. In terms of advanced metering, in many regards, probably has many of the functionality capability that that we've discussed earlier today, and we continue to look at capability in existing stores and pilot stores throughout the U.S. And you can just go to the next slide. It just has a little bit of background on the installation. Usage and demand, data tracking, interval data set up to 15 minutes, but can go down to the 5-minute capability for demand response compliance, real-time monitoring from any computer. And next slide is just a summary of information about the type of the different usage that's monitored on a real-time basis or 15 minutes. And the next slide is just a little bit of additional background on how sophisticated we go down into the individual devices. Through individual meters and showing the usage on a real-time basis.
You have 30 seconds.
That's all I have. Thank you very much.
We'll now take questions, starting with Vice Chairman Christie.
Pamela, thank you for your testimony. I think the industrial's participation in the PJM load reduction programs is quite significant, as you show here in your papers. In 2008, we curtailed 40,554 megawatts. In 2007, it was about 49,000 megawatts. And that's out of a peak demand of 150,000 megawatts across the system, something
roughly, I believe.
If you look at the reduction between 2007 and 2008, it's about 9,000 megawatts. Mm-hmm. This is a tough question. I don't know if you have the answer to it, but what did it cost, or what would it have cost PJM to pay you that 9,000 megawatts based upon the previous economic response program versus what they may have spent on RPM payments for that 9,000 megawatts?
You know, Vice Chairman, I don't know the answer to that. I will get back to you with it. I try not to do math in public as a lawyer, so but I will certainly follow up with your office and the commission with that information if you'd like it.
Yeah, it drives to my fundamental position that we should always look for the least cost methodology of meeting a consumer demand. And if it's by adding capacity through RPM, great. Or if it's by an economic response program, it should be done by the economic response program. One other quick question. You mentioned here that there's some possible adjustments to the interruptible load for reliability program. Is this a program where you have to bid all or nothing for 3 years, or is it a year-to-year program?
It is a year-to-year program, and there is a program within RPM where load can bid in 3 years in advance and participate in those clearing auctions. As you'll see from the statistics in our testimony, that has not been as popular as the interruptible load for reliability program, which is a more near-term commitment. And from our perspective and talking to customers, it is difficult to say 3 years in advance that I'm going to be able to curtail load by 1 megawatt or 2 megawatts and commit to that. However, if you're just doing it by March 1 for this summer, which is how that interruptible load for reliability program works, that is something that a customer can say, yes, I can participate and I can commit to being that resource.
Thank you. Just one more quick question for the Walmart fellow. I guess just make sure that we don't do anything to get in your way. You seem to be doing everything you need to be doing without any government involvement or any government programs. So if we step in your way, please let us know.
Will do.
Commissioner Powelson.
Thank you to our panelists. Sonny, I want to hone in on something you addressed, is this lease cost over time, which I think we struggled with in procurement language in Act 129, but that coupled with the fact that internally we have to implement or do the forecasting for the load factor from, I guess, 2010, 2011. So my first question to you is, help me better understand, and I struggle with this lease cost over time provision, and then your thoughts on what we could do as a commission in what do we need to do in terms of getting it right on load forecast?
If I could, I'd start with the second question. On the load forecast, the law specifically requires that the commission complete a load forecast for each utility for the what I call the base year, 2010-2011. To my knowledge, the commission has never had to do that before. The commission has always relied on the utilities for load forecasts, and the commission then publishes those load forecasts. My thought and what we said in our comments was this is an area where the commission may need outside assistance to assist the commission staff, and there are experts who can do that with data from the utilities, provide you the load forecast, and the legislation specifically states that when the commission incurs costs, specifically states that when the commission incurs costs to implement this law, it may recover that money from the utilities. So I think that this is a case where this particular task, you may require additional assistance. When it comes to lease cost over time, with respect to the demand side portion of this and the total resource cost test, which I support, the total resource cost test in the statute specifically talks about the value of the project, value of the expenditures over the life of the program up to, in the case of demand side, up to 15 years. So I think it is important, and certainly under the total resource cost test on the demand side, you can look at benefits over the entire life of the program. When it comes to the procurement side, I think the General Assembly said, by saying over time, I believe they were distinguishing between the old law, which specifically said prevailing market prices, which had been interpreted in a very narrow manner, suggesting that we were only looking, at least interpreted by some as saying we were only looking at those prices on a very short-term basis. And I think by saying over time, the General Assembly was not specifying any particular time, but saying it was not just a narrow viewpoint. I would note that they did also include a requirement for consideration of long-term contracts, which must be more than 4 years, but no more than 20 years.
Thank you very much, and that concludes my questions.
Commissioner Pittsengrilli.
Thank you. Just a quick question on funding. I think both Pam and Business Advocate, maybe Sonny, you did as well, recommended there be coordination about the funding mechanisms between federal and state. Do you have any ideas on what role the commission can play, seeing that some of the funding is administered by other agencies?
I was prompted to make that observation because I recently took the continuing legal education program that focused on alternative energy and energy conservation. And on the panel were two administration officials talking about all the money they've got in different pots, some of which I knew about, some of which I didn't. If I didn't, I'm quite sure that most of my clients don't know anything about it. And so it's, well, every year they're oversubscribed right away, and that's great. But it's only being oversubscribed by those people who were fortunate enough or sophisticated enough to know about it. Then I heard all about, well, the utilities through this legislation are going to have a requirement to have a plan, and the costs are going to be borne by ratepayers. So it strikes me that we've got a potential for silo effect. And what ought to happen is that the EDC, whether it's through an energy audit or whether it's through some other conservation service provider, ought to go to an individual business and say, okay, this is what you need to do to save X amount of energy. And the small business says, oh my goodness, I can't afford to do that. I've got an upfront cost, and who knows if I'll even be here in 5 years. So then you look to see, is there a Commonwealth program that might be able to provide either a grant or a low interest loan to help to cover that cost? And that EDC or that conservation service provider then shepherds the customer through the process of applying for the money. If there's not, then is that something that's available through the EDC's plan? And that was my point. I mean, that if there's money available for particular kinds of things in different pots, there's no reason to require the utility to raise the same amount of money and charge ratepayers for it.
Thank you. Pam, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I would agree. I think that an important role that the commission can play is just by having the inventory of what is out there for customers so that, again, when there is an initiative that they'd like to pursue, to shepherd them in the way of a potential funding source to offset a portion of it. But certainly, you know, on the Commonwealth end, I mean, we are obviously implementing a Commonwealth policy in terms of energy efficiency and conservation, and you know, any efforts that could be undertaken by the Commission to reach out to other agencies that have those funding sources available, I think should be. I can't tell you exactly how to do it, but it's obviously something that occurred to my clients and to the small business advocate, because we do see, again, government dollars, which are taxpayer dollars, going to energy efficiency and renewable projects, but then we also see ratepayers potentially being asked to pay for very similar efforts.
Thank you. I think it's an important issue, and I think this morning we talked with Secretary Hanger about coordination among the agencies, and I believe some of us at the Commission will be meeting with him next week to discuss these very same issues, so appreciate your comments.
Commissioner Gardner?
I have no questions, but I would like to thank the panel for showing up today and sharing their counsel with us.
Chairman Cawley. Sonny, I noticed that you assiduously avoided taking a position on which way we should interpret the baseline requirement. Knowing you as I do, that had to be intentional. Are you keeping your powder dry, or you want to hear the arguments on both sides, or do you have an opinion?
No, I did assiduously avoid that. No, I've heard very good arguments on both sides. I know I've spoken to Roger Clark, who you'll hear from, on the side that it requires an absolute reduction. John Hanger, who, of course, had as much to do with the passage of this portion of the law as anyone in Pennsylvania, took the position that it's an energy savings requirement. Like I said, I think that's a tough call, and I think you'll have to make it. I think either reading can be justified under the statute. What I don't think, though, what I did want to caution about is, though, you have to be, in my opinion, you have to be consistent, which is, if it is a requirement that these be utility-sponsored, effectively utility-sponsored energy savings or utility-sponsored demand savings, then you really have to make sure that they are utility-sponsored energy savings, that they're not getting credit for all the incredible stuff that Walmart has done over the last 5 years, that they're not getting double credit for what PJM is already doing. Now, having said that, I think they do get credit for the work of the competitive conservation service providers that they hire under the Act. So I don't want to suggest that they personally have to do it. I think they can get credit for the work that is done by the conservation service providers on their behalf. I just think you have to be consistent and pick one or the other, and let the utilities know what the requirements are under the Act.
And by the way, I agree with you that the penalties are mandatory, but
If the day comes that those penalties need to be assessed, it will not only be the failure of the electric utilities, it'll be our failure as well, because this commission must keep on top of this to see how their utilities are doing. And because the Act also requires that we change these programs if we see that they're going awry, if they're not achieving the goals. And therefore, if it comes to an abject failure, it will be ours as well. Bill.
I'd like to comment on that question that you just asked, Mr. Popowski. I don't believe that the Act requires that all of the savings in order to count has to come from the specific utility programs, and that's what I tried to say. I abridged in my testimony, I think it is going to be almost impossible for anybody to show that reduced consumption over the next 5 years was a result of a specific utility program, a result of a heightened public awareness of how important it is to do conservation, a result of whatever may come out of Washington. And I don't read the Act as saying, well, we have to show, if for example, the end of the rate caps do what advocates of market competition say they will, which is drive up prices and therefore drive down consumption, I don't know why that shouldn't count. I mean, the goal here is to reduce consumption to meet the mandated level that the Act 129 provides for. And I think it's going to be a thankless chore, lots of litigation, to try to prove that this consumption was reduced because of a particular program and not because somebody turned off the light or turned up the air conditioning. So it's going to be hard enough to try to isolate for the economic downturn and how much of this decline in consumption was a result of the economic downturn. I wouldn't compound it by trying to prove that every kWh saved came from this particular source.
Thank you. Ms. Palachuk, Mr. DeBroff, thank you for your points. Your points on PJM are well taken, by the way, and as you know, that's a continuing concern of this commission. Walmart, well done. Maybe we ought to establish a market for energy conservation credits, and you can sell them because you're going to have lots left over the way you're doing it. I compliment the company not only for its measures in its own self-interest, but for also encouraging the development of solar in Pennsylvania with some of the projects that you've hosted on your roofs. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Finally, we have panel 7 consisting of the environmental and advocacy groups, and the first speaker will be Ms. Lane on behalf of the Citizens for Pennsylvania's Future, or Penn Future.
I'd first like to thank the commission.
One second, wait. Go ahead.
Commission for giving me the opportunity to speak today. On behalf of Penn Future, I want to highlight from my written testimony the importance of proper measurement and verification techniques to ensure that.
Could you speak up, please?
Sure. To ensure that energy efficiency and conservation plans are achieving the required Act 129 goals, and to the importance of utility collaboration and program design. First, we urge the Commission to forecast out the annual kilowatt hour and kilowatt reduction goals for each service territory that will ensure that utilities are progressing towards their required 1%, 3%, and 4.5% reductions. Creating such annual targets will provide utilities with firm goals that must be reached and enable them to better craft their portfolio of programs. States like New York that have also enacted percentage reductions, in their case 15% by 2015, have forecasted out their annual reduction savings in this manner. If this is done each year when the utilities file their annual reports, both the annual and lifetime savings achieved from their programs will be able to measure up with these goals and enable everyone to view how they are progressing towards the final goals. We also recommend that the Commission expand upon the technical reference manual created for the AEPS to create a rigorous statewide measurement, verification, and evaluation protocol to ensure that reported savings are occurring due to energy efficiency and conservation programs and not to extraneous factors such as economic or weather conditions. It is also important to do so to avoid having programs evaluated with a multitude of methodologies which would result in incompatible data and confusing results. As mentioned in my written testimony, there are several evaluation methods that have been successfully utilized in other states, including calculating participant and non-participant spillover, that will allow the Commission to ensure that utilities are only receiving credit for their electricity reduction savings achieved from the implementation of programs. We also recommend that the Commission be the entity that is the one to hire the independent evaluators to conduct these studies to avoid potential influence by the utilities. When it comes to designing programs, it is critical that the utilities do not create their plans in a silo. Based on discussions with program administrators in other states, representatives from the California PUC, ACEEE, and Northeast Energy Efficiency Partnerships, it is clear that energy efficiency and conservation initiatives benefit from consistency across programs. Collaboration between utilities and developing programs is beneficial in that it reduces program costs through economies of scale, avoids unnecessary program overlap that may cause confusion among customers and contractors, improves transparency, and increases the effectiveness of marketing and branding. Penn Future is very aware that due to differences in building stock between certain utility service territories, the same set of programs may not always be appropriate. However, where there are common programs between utilities, it is important that these programs share certain standards. These would include common eligibility thresholds, for instance, what's the minimum efficiency rating that would be allowed for a qualified HVAC unit to get a rebate. Also, additionally, standardized rebates and incentive levels across these programs. This type of standardization makes it easier for equipment providers and retailers to work with their distribution chains to supply energy efficiency equipment used in these programs. California provides an excellent example of what can occur when utilities do not work together. When California originally mandated its energy conservation programs, the utilities were required to plan and implement their portfolio of programs and did so without collaborating. It did not take long for certain customer segments and those that provide efficiency technology and services like manufacturers, distributors, and builders to ask for common program features statewide to make it easier to play in the market. In the end, programs had to be amended to create a group of core programs with some common elements. We hope Pennsylvania will learn from this experience, and we urge the Commission to facilitate utility collaboration. There are several ways to accomplish this goal. In Massachusetts, the utilities mostly work together to implement their programs. They will either submit joint RFPs and contract with a single service provider, or they will each submit its own RFP and bid out to their own conservation service provider separately, but will make sure that equipment, incentive levels, and branding are coordinated across their service territories. While we recommend that where feasible, common programs should share standardized incentive levels and equipment eligibility levels, there are several programs that benefit from statewide implementation. Two such programs that were mentioned earlier were the new construction and residential retrofit program that PA Home Energy is currently undertaking. Because these programs engage builders, developers, architects, contractors, and trade allies that serve not only multiple service territories, but also multiple states and regions, we believe that these should be delivered in a consistent standard. Inconsistent or multiple new construction and residential retrofit programs across the state would prove ineffective and only confuse the marketplace. This concludes my statement, and I look forward to any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Next, we have Mr. Clark on behalf of the Reinvestment Fund.
Good afternoon, and thank you all for being here. Not only sticking with us the whole day, but all the other proactive work you've done. You've given us all numerous opportunities to comment, to give feedback, and I know there's more opportunities ahead. I also want to thank everybody that's testified. This positive spirit about how we work together to accomplish Act 29 is noticeable, especially for those of us who have been in this field a while, and we remember the old days when energy conservation efficiency was seen like a crazy idea and kind of a joke. But those days are over, and I'm grateful for that. I think we have a lot of work to do. We all recognize that. One of the biggest challenges for the Commission is the January 15th deadline for what I call the Act 129 guidelines, the rules that you will be setting forth for the utility plans. And to the extent humanly possible, those guidelines simply need to reduce any ambiguity in what is otherwise a fairly ambiguous act in certain areas. We've talked about this statement of the goals, and numerous parties throughout the day have addressed that. That's one example of ambiguity that needs to be resolved. I think the utilities are eager to move forward. They just need to know what the rules are, as do we all. So that's the challenge that we have to work with. Let me mention the goals. I talk about this quite a bit in my testimony, and I had an appendix that I worked up, just a spreadsheet of what some of those numbers might be. And as people said earlier, the difference between this absolute reduction and the savings approach, which says this is the size of the bucket of savings we must make, is about 2-to-1. So it's significant. I personally think the legislation's takes the reduction approach, the language of the legislation. I don't know how to explain the comment about extraordinary load other than talk about reductions, but maybe the Commission could poll the General Assembly and say, did you think that this bill was going to reduce the total sales, or was this simply going to make it a little bit lower than it might otherwise be under the business as usual approach? One question or issue that has not come up under the savings approach to all of this is the question of, for how long may you count the savings of a measure? For example, a compact fluorescent light bulb was installed at the very end of 2009. How much of that savings do you count towards the savings approach goal in 2013? Do you add up all the savings over the entire 48 months and say, well, that bulb saved 57 kilowatt hours times 4 years, and that's how much it saved? Or is the savings goal simply an annual rate of savings? It's how much we've saved in the last year. And in my comments in Appendix B, which I submitted under the other docket, that distinction is also about a 2-to-1 difference. If you let the savings accumulate in terms of the goal description, you allow the total savings to be about half of what they are. If you say, no, we're only going to consider savings each calendar or each 12-month period. So there's another issue where I hope we get guidance from the Commission. As to the forecast, I agree with what Sonny said. It's the Commission's responsibility. We have seen the Commission's forecast in the electricity power reports, but this is going to be something very much more important. How we consider, for example, the current economic recession we are in and how that will affect the times. And it's June 1st, 2009 through May 31st, 2010. That's the base year. Sonny was off by a year. But it's that time, and we will still probably be, from what I'm reading, in the midst of some economic hardship. And how is that going to impact our numbers? What do we mean by weather normalize? The Commission's been thrown into the weeds about that issue a number of cases in the past, but we need in these guidelines some very clear analysis of what that will be, how the utilities will do that, how you will do that when you're comparing the goals. And again, the extraordinary load. In my mind, that's extraordinary. Is that a national emergency? Maybe it's something like if we start really adopting plug-in hybrid automobiles, some very, very new load. But I don't believe it's what the Energy Association of Pennsylvania listed, which was a number of really very ordinary ups and downs in the market cycles, and I don't think that's what the General Assembly meant by extraordinary load. The chairman mentioned the necessity of the commission to remain active, and mid-course correction is the last point I want to make. We need, I hope, in the guidelines to have a process where the annual evaluation reports coming in, how they get shared with people, how we meet to discuss them, and how we decide what response is appropriate. What programs do we diminish, which do we increase, and how do we change things? So staying active and proactive is going to be critical to all of this. Thank you very much.
Finally, we have Ms. Robinson on behalf of the Energy Coordinating Agency.
Thank you, Commissioners, for this opportunity to testify. Can you hear me?
A little bit closer.
Thank you, Commissioners, for this opportunity to testify, and I don't take it personally that you saved me for last. I'm just impressed that you're all still hanging in here at the end of a very long day. I'm going to just comment on 5 points in my written testimony, and I'll start by making a recommendation that I think it would be, given the range of issues that have to be decided and the complexity of this task ahead of you and the relatively short period of time you have to do it, that it may be advisable for the Commission to develop a working group similar to the working group that was developed and working out the details of the EPS, so an energy efficiency working group, perhaps. And just to remind you that the state, the Department of Environmental Protection, has commissioned the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy to do one of their studies of the entire state's energy efficiency and solar resources. That first draft will be available before the end of this month, and we'd like to send that to all the commissioners and key staff for your review. I think that will provide some very helpful guidance on the issues that you're wrestling with. I want to echo the comments that Courtney just made about evaluation. Evaluation is going to be absolutely critical, and both to avoid confusion, avoid conflicts, and avoid a situation where you can't really ferret out the facts from the fiction, I think it's going to be essential to have a single evaluator statewide who is evaluating. You can do this across a class of customers. So the residential class, all those programs are evaluated by one evaluator, and then likewise in the commercial class. Otherwise, the likelihood of confused results is enormous, and also the opportunity for utilities to, you know, put their thumb on the scale is also pretty great. I'd like to just counter some of the points I heard made through the day that it will be difficult to disaggregate the impacts of the recession or federal programs from utility-created activity. I think that reveals a lack of understanding of evaluation and a lack of confidence in good evaluators. Good evaluators do this all the time. They simply look at participants versus non-participants, and there are many ways of disaggregating other external impacts. So I don't think that's as hard as it's made out to be. Comment about program design. I would like to recommend that I think the intention of the language of the Act with regard to serving all customer classes is very instructive. And I think we heard today here that certain approaches are going to be much more effective and cost-effective in the commercial class. I think that's certainly true. But I think we're also facing a situation which is growing affordability gap in the residential sector as well as in commercial customers. And in order to address the affordability, energy affordability issue, which is getting to be bigger and bigger all the time. It is going to be essential to do to meet the goals of the Act within each class. So reducing consumption within the residential class as well as within the commercial and industrial classes. I think that is, in fact, the intent of the law and certainly of the legislators. And I'd like to draw particular attention to this problem of the working poor and elderly on pensions. This is a group that currently do not qualify for the low-income usage reduction program. They're above 150% of poverty, but below median income. That group, as you know, is getting hammered, and they're starting to hemorrhage. And the utility termination rates right now are extraordinary.
30 seconds.
So that group is going to need a particular care in figuring out how they participate in programs. And my last point is education, and I found it really exciting to hear that a number of people who spoke previously today spoke about the importance of energy education. This is an area that we cannot overemphasize, the value of energy conservation education. And again, one that I believe personally, it would be best to take a statewide approach. And this is something I think that will require collaboration with other parts of state government, but that the commission itself needs to take leadership in developing a strong statewide consumer education program. It will be, Courtney used the words, confusing to consumers. I think anything that is not statewide has the potential for tremendous confusion for consumers who may be in different service territories but may live across the street from one another. So it's essential to get education going and to get it going right. And I look forward to working with you on implementing this extremely exciting legislation.
Thank you. We'll now take questions, starting with Vice Chairman Christie.
I just have one comment, then I'll throw it back to our panelists here. Thank you all for your testimony. Very good thoughts there. We very much appreciate that. I've spent a considerable amount of time with the issue of how do you prove the result of a program. And in my opinion, the only way that you can do it at the end of the day is you have to put an end-use meter on every application, and then you will know whether or not you got the savings. But from a practical perspective, that just doesn't make any sense. You just can't do it. And I think I agree with Mr. Lloyd in his comments that once you embark on a program, you make the implementation of that program, there's so many factors that are out of our control. The weather in 2008 compared to 2012 will be completely different. Warm summer, cold winter. There'll be change in the number of people in a home. You'll have different appliances. Very simply, if somebody puts in a compact fluorescent light bulb and then they put in a plasma TV, how do you measure from that household perspective what really, really happened? And so I think at the end of the day, there's only one real way to do this, and that way is to do the deemed savings approach. You look at the program up front, and you say if you need to reduce your peak demand by 500 megawatts, well, how many compact fluorescent light bulbs does the utility need to put in place? How many load control switches on air conditioners and water heaters? And then you challenge the utility. We know from an engineering calculation perspective how many you need to do. Come back to us in 3 or 4 years, and then we audit the program and we look at, did they indeed meet the those targets? Perhaps you can have an audit program to make sure those switches have worked, do some random auditing. But I really don't think there's any other way to do it, and I think we have to be very careful here that if we put too much effort in trying to evaluate the results at the end of the day, there's only so much savings here in these programs. And if you take a lot of administrative costs on trying to pinpoint something which, in my opinion, is unattainable, I think it's an exercise in futility. So I appreciate some comments.
I would just urge to look at some of the evaluation manuals from other states. I do agree that deem savings are applicable to certain measures. However, if you go up to more whole house programs or custom approaches, higher levels of meter reading or other sampling engineering estimates are suitable. The International Measurement Verification Protocol offers a set of options that vary by rigor and cost, and they detail out what types of program measures should or do need more intensive measurement and verification. A lot of states around the country use this, NYSERDA, California, most of the New England states. And all of these states, the average they're spending on evaluation is between 2 to 5% of their budgets. So it is possible to not spend that much but still verify savings appropriately.
Yeah, I would echo. I'm very familiar with evaluation as part of the LIAR program. And what I would say is that there are good evaluators in this country and there are bad evaluators. So I think it is very critical that the evaluations be performed by very experienced and credible evaluators whose work is proven. I really do think that this is a critical area. I think also it's very important not to be too dependent on projections of any kind. I think deemed savings have merit, but they're very limited, and it will not get you where you need to go, and it will be necessary to use impact evaluation. And I would strongly urge the Commission not to rely on projected savings from software packages. At this current state of their development, almost all software that predicts savings are actually overestimating savings. They're overstating savings. And this is not a path I think we need to go down. I think that will lead to a lack of confidence on the part of consumers when it becomes clear that the savings were not 40%, but in fact were 20%. So I think we need to have real hard data impact evaluation as part. And it's going to require making the right decision.
Thank you. We might not quite agree on this one, but appreciate your comments on that. I spent a good deal of my life working on as a third party providing energy services to Heinz, and our goal was to provide them with programs that would result in a 5% savings target. And we had one of the most sophisticated models and tried to look at adjusting for weather, adjusting for production shifts, adjusting for the number of ketchup bottles coming out, trying to adjust for when some of the workers would leave the windows open. And at the end of the day, we all threw our hands up in the air and we just said it was absolutely impossible to try to, with any accuracy, determine if we were entitled to a reward or a penalty for our meeting the 5% target. And so we just simply fell back on the engineering calculations of the technologies that we implemented. We put in compressors, we put in the new heaters, wastewater heater recovery type of projects. We did all those different kind of technologies, and at the end of the day, that was the only way we found that we could do it.
I think the difference is that I think you're right on an individual building. I think you're absolutely right that you have to actually meter end uses on one building. But if we're talking programs across hundreds or thousands of customers, you then have a much different situation and you can compare a large group of customers, and all of that behavioral change washes out across when you compare the participant group to the non-participant group. So it's I think, you know, you're absolutely right though on an individual building basis.
Thank you, Liz.
Commissioner Powelson.
Thank you to our panelists again for taking the time out to be with us. Today is system overload for us, and again, it's late in the day, and Liz, by the way, you're back by popular demand, so...
take all the concepts in of what we've done in Act 129, and I want to ask just, maybe it's the $64,000 question here, but in a minute, each one of you, what do we have to do to get it right? Because I'm nervous, and Vice Chairman and I have talked about this, that we're going to run into paralysis by analysis here. We're going to miss some opportunities, but the most efficient way for us to implement this program, and what you would like to, what's the best outcome, because I'm a firm believer good inputs will yield good outputs, what would you like to see an efficient energy conservation demand side program look like here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania? And I know I'm less than a minute, it's tough to do, but who wants to go first?
I'll go first. I think we first of all have to recognize it's a fiction that we'll get it right. To me, the most important thing is that we have a program and a process that can evolve over time. We will try things. We will gather the results. We will decide what's working well and what isn't, and we'll adjust and we'll move forward. So to me, the most important thing is, how do we create a process that keeps the involvement of all of the parties, that collects the data that it needs, and then is open to honest discussions about how things are going and what changes we need to make. Because you're absolutely right. If we are trying to figure out all perfectly by January 15th, we won't be able to do that. I think, for example, even between now and July 1st, when the utility plans are due, I think there's several things that the Commission should be doing and revising and announcing. It's not just January 15th and then you're quiet for 5.5 months. It's an active, proactive process. I think creating these utility plans is not just going to be the utilities going in their corner and saying, here's our plan. Hopefully, it's all of us working together. How we bring different utilities together, for example, for those activities that do make sense to do statewide, I'm concerned about multiple brands of the same kind of activity. I think there's a lot of work. I respect there's some differences in service territory characteristics, but I think to a large extent, there are a lot of similarities. So how can the Commission proactively work with the utilities to say, I think in these areas, let's see if we can come up with a statewide program that all of you can support rather than confusing everybody with all these different approaches. So it's, how do you remain proactive and how do we adjust over time? That's, I think, the single most important thing I would stress.
I agree with Roger, and I think that the long term, I think we're facing some very big challenges with energy. I think we will see supply constraints in the not too distant future. I think the long term picture is full of rocks ahead of, you know, in the road, and we need to use this opportunity to build a different situation for all consumers in the Commonwealth, that energy will remain affordable. It's going to look different than it used to look. So I hope that we don't yield to a temptation for, you know, just, you know, a kind of a silver bullet flash approach, because I don't think there is one for all customer classes, and that we use this opportunity to build capacity in the state for the long term.
I would agree with both those comments. I guess in the short term, what I think is needed are specific hard targets for utilities to meet, and then, as Roger mentioned, some type of working group before the plans are implemented, where the utilities are getting together with retail providers or conservation service providers, representatives in the region who have implemented these programs. There's best-in-class examples of programs that are similar across all the states with energy efficiency programs, And I think if we want to get programs up quickly, there's programs we can learn from to get an equitable distribution across customer classes. And then from there, the longer term goals that Roger mentioned to sort of look back at how things are going and to reassess and to grow programs to achieve sort of the higher hanging fruit, less cost effective programs down the road would be great.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your feedback here today, and we look forward to working with you. So thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Pittsengrilli?
Thank you. I don't have any specific questions today, but just want to thank you for your comments, and I know you'll stay engaged over the next several months to help us make sure we implement it in the most efficient way.
Absolutely. We're all in this together.
Commissioner Gardner.
I want to associate myself with Commissioner Pittsengrilli's comments earlier. I don't want to stand in the way of our getting out of here and getting home to our friends and family. But one of the things that I think is inferred from this panel is that energy prices are very likely to continue to increase. And one of the most effective tools that we can have is going to be conservations to mitigate the rate of increase in energy prices. And I think that overall, what I'm looking for has got to be a change in consumer behavior so that as energy prices increase, the negative impact that it has on them will be minimized. And I think that what I'm hearing from this panel kind of states that purpose, but if I got it wrong, please give me some feedback.
No, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, this is an area that's been an abstraction to most people for way too long. When I deal with buildings and we finance at the Sustainable Development Fund, we finance a lot of charter schools and nonprofit organizations and others. And what I always say is my goal is to have people spend as much time thinking about the HVAC system in their building as they do the material on the lobby floor. You know, because there's all these endless debates about tile or this or that. Well, there aren't those debates about the energy systems, and that's we need to make everybody realize that that's important. I think it's coming. As Liz said, there are fundamental forces at work that are going to squeeze energy prices higher and higher. And the recent drop is temporary. We'll be back up, I think, fairly soon once this recession's over.
Chairman Cawley?
Well, to conclude this wonderful day, I would simply note that we have before us representatives from three nonprofit corporations who do exemplary work in this field. And I know from being in this town a long time that you professionally have dedicated your lives to this as well. The funding provided by Special Session Bill, or House Bill 1, and implementation of this act is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, not only for you, but for this commission, and for all of the people that we represent. So, thank you for your testimony. We look forward to a continuing dialogue and advice from you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is there anything further at this point that the commissioners wish to address? Any closing statements? Very well. We are adjourned.